a joint interview with Donald Cook and Reuben Welch in the Melville Library, Thursday, June 16, 1988. All right, we'll go as long as that little button there is red. Do you want to start? And which one of you would like to start first? Who came first?
Bondas.
Don, you came first.
Yes.
Start on the questions, and just so that we have things fairly systematic, and then we will leave the questions and so on.
Well, my name is Donald Cook, and I work in the library. I've worked in the library since its inception. Came to Stony Brook Oyster Bay in 1957. I was 25 at the time. In fact, this was the first full-time professional position that I had, so I've worked all of my professional career at Stony Brook and Oyster Bay. I believe that I would have to say that Leonard Olson was responsible for my coming to Stony Brook. When I applied for a position with the college at Oyster Bay, I was more interested in going through an interview experience than looking for a serious job. I was writing a thesis at the time and expected to continue that, but found the prospects of Oyster Bay, later Stony Brook, so attractive that I decided to postpone completing the thesis until...
Thesis in what field?
In library science.
In library science?
Mm-hmm.
Columbia?
No, Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah, the University of Chicago required a thesis that time. And,
I see.
So that's why I'm here. I think that the factors that were most pressing or important in the decision was the sense that Olson gave of this being an institution that was going to be dynamic and an interesting place to work, and it certainly has been that. He indicated that the primary goal of the college was to train teachers in science and math, but I think at the back of his mind, even then, he felt that it could evolve into something more. At least that's the impression I got from him. I'm sure he never stated that explicitly, but it seemed to me that he was hoping that it would be a kind of experimental school, and one that would introduce some of the University of Chicago teaching methodologies. And
he interviewed you at Chicago?
No, in Albany. I had finished my coursework at Chicago, and since I was writing a thesis that related to the history of libraries in New York State, I had a part-time job at the New York State Library, and his office was there.
He was with Carlson, wasn't he?
Yes.
In Carlson.
He had asked the Mason Tolman, who was on the staff at Albany, if Tolman knew any librarians who might be interested in jobs. Tolman knew I was nearly finished with the thesis, so he suggested I might be a candidate, and that's how I came to be here. My impressions of Oyster Bay when I first came were that it was totally undeveloped and yet an absolutely beautiful place to be working. There was nothing in terms of library. It was an empty building and with lots of planning and work to do. And since I had no real experience as a librarian, I'm not sure that I knew quite how to start, but start we did. Getting down to the expectations that I had when I came, I think I saw the initial appointment as perhaps the first appointment in a career that might involve moving on to something else somewhere, but obviously that's not happened. the work involved essentially building the collection from staff and services from nothing. And that involved, of course, primarily work at the Oyster Bay campus and limited work outside the campus.
Did you, what proportion of the acquisition at that time were you providing, and what proportions came as suggestions from members of the faculty? How did you go about it?
Well, the approach I used initially was to ask faculty what their immediate needs were, and those tended to relate to the teaching program.
Right.
Beyond that, I think I tried to identify some rather basic list that any college library might have. The one that was seemed to be most appropriate was the Harvard College catalog, which had been published fairly recently at that time, and that seemed to be a kind of a working list. Of course, there were the basic reference tools that needed to be bought, and that was the beginning.
Incidentally, what is the size of the collection now?
It's about 1,300,000 volumes.
1,300,000. All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I think I've covered most of the questions that are here. What do I think that I've accomplished at Stony Brook, that I had accomplished at Stony Brook by 1971? Well, I guess the things that had been achieved by 71, that the basic nucleus of the collection was here. We were on the threshold, I think, of becoming a research library. It was shortly after that that we joined such organizations as the Association for Research Libraries. We, shortly after that, were involved in the OCLC bibliographic database. The period from 57 through about 72 was one of very intensive acquisition and growth of collections.
And building.
Yes,
there,
right.
I think
right.
You omitted that,
right.
But you played a rather important role.
The library, well, the first building, the core building, was done in about 1962, and then planning for this major extension to the building was being done in as late as 1971.
It was
completed in the early 70s. But
do you want to get into the planning of the original library building, the red brick building? Your relations with Albany on that? And
I think, from my perspective, Reuben was in charge of the library. Reuben joined the library in 58, in August of 58, a year after I, and was director of the library for much of the period of time that's covered here. My impression, and you can correct me, Reuben, is that the library staff's involvement in the planning of the old red brick building was rather limited. It was
quite limited.
Quite limited.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who did it?
Was it Steve? Isn't that Steve?
Elwin Stevens.
Stevens. Wasn't he one of the prime movers?
Right. And
Keegan.
The
architect. Yeah,
yes.
The architect and the construction fund.
Well, there was no construction fund then.
No, at that time there wasn't, that's right.
Well, Maurice Walker, Smith and Haynes was the constructor, the architectural
firm
that was the site planners, and I guess the firm that did the building plan itself.
Right.
I'm not aware that we even did much in terms of the building program for that one. It was,
I don't recall it either. I don't recall it.
A basic...
It was done for us.
Rectangle,
essentially,
right.
Essentially.
By the people in Albany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was their conception of what a library should be for, what, a liberal arts college?
Yes, it was about 100,000 square feet. So
yes.
But they had that experience there, mm-hmm. both campuses, of course.
And the conception was that was to be... supplemented at some future time by a tower to the north end of the, that building, out in the direction of the graduate chemistry building. I think they even had some plans of how that building might look. It would be a tower.
I think there was one trip, but I can't quite place it, to the University of Toronto to look at their library. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that building. That is a library which is real, well above ground and in a, not a real tower, but in a raised, rather vertical structure. A large library.
More than five floors, in other words.
Yes.
More than what we have now.
Yes. There was. I don't recall being at that, but there would have been no reason for me to have been.
Just a friendly exploration. Mm-hmm. Nothing official about it. But just,
Memory begins to fail.
It does.
From a distance of 30 years.
There is a failure of memory, and there may be a certain censorship or self-censorship factor, too, that creeps in. Sometimes you don't admit it, but it's probably there.
Well, can you say much about the budget, procedures at that time? How was the budget for the library developed? Did you work with Olson, or did you work with John Lee?
Usually we worked with the business officer.
I see.
There were a number of them. Conway was the first one.
There was someone by the name of
Charlie Cooper.
Yeah.
And then I think it was gradually Mitch Gerstel. Who was the liaison man. But it was usually that end of the campus that which made me believe, rightly or wrongly, that we were, in a way, I don't want to put this wrongly, but that we were, in a way, kept a few paces away from the chief decision makers, and that by the time budget planning got to the library, or budget discussions got to the library, some other intervening levels had already had their say. So,
by the same token, I think that the funds available for such things as acquisitions were. Mm. Relatively generous, for the most part.
Oh, very much so, yes.
We oftentimes had requests for positions that we were given and were never filled, in fact. Vacancies. It reflected the climate of the period. The librarians were in short supply during the late 50s and 60s, and so that we had great difficulty in recruiting people to come to the area. Mm.
Not everyone has the stomach for something that looks very much like a pioneering situation. The really impressive, nationally known figures generally don't pick that. That's not where they make their name and fame.
Right.
And so it's a difficult thing.
Librarians are more conservative.
Some are.
possibly, but I think in the case of these greater established figures, I think they're just smart. I mean, they'd be knocking their heads against the wall and so on. They'd do the difficult work that has to be done, fighting for positions and so on, and for this and that. While where they are, they can be what you might call statesmen in the profession.
Right. Can you give the approximate size of the budget, the annual budget?
I have data that
you
can supply
data.
You.
It's available anyway.
Yes, or certainly the numbers of volumes are required per year and that sort of thing. There is some data, not necessarily from year one, but certainly through much of this period.
Well, the budget, I believe, got to be, the acquisition budget went over $1 million, didn't it?
Yes.
By, I would say, 1960,
right.
When, 67?
I'm sure I had
some. I think at the time, by the time Rothko Rouse was here,
yes.
It may have reached that level.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because we found a way to recruit staff mm-hmm. by somewhat less orthodox ways, by putting in a force of technical assistance for mm-hmm. Sylvia, under a different label.
Right.
And they told a certain, just in processing and working up all this mass of material.
Yeah, I think, too, one of the dramatic things that happened was the lot purchases that
mm-hmm.
became very much a part of the acquisitions program of the 60s.
By lot, you mean what?
Well, collections that had been pulled together either by booksellers, by scholars, by anyone who had some either subject interest or just interested in books or what have you. For example, bought a collection that was labeled the Lindmark Collection, some over 60,000 items, which had been collected by a book dealer, and many of very fine things, standard American authors, that sort of thing. Another collection that we got was a gift from, I'm trying to remember, Benjamin, the collection from that we picked up in New York.
That was the Kelly?
Well, the Kelly collection was a social science collection. I was thinking the one where there were the publisher's standard sets we got in Lower New York. If you remember that basement storehouse that had, I'm sure you were there in the process.
Could be. Sometimes we went in on it with a truck ourselves.
It was about 10,000 volumes, and much of the stuff was standard.
No,
Barkfield's the art dealer, and we bought a lot of things from
Paul,
him.
Yes,
right.
He wasn't given it away. But
Nicholas Kelly. And
Nicholas Kelly,
right,
yeah, that's the
Kelly collection.
In the downtown.
Right,
and
Kelly was, one of his relatives was a publisher in economics, I believe.
Yes, Augustus.
Right, yeah. Yeah. But
Cooper Union gave us all sorts of things.
Right.
Not always the things that you would go out and look for, but when you have nothing and try to put things together, of course, almost everything comes in handy in some way.
The Cooper Union collection was primarily
government documents.
They were cutting back on that.
That's right.
For me.
Did you educate the faculty gradually to help you in your selection? Well,
I think they thought you were already educated.
Yes, I think they were trying to educate us as they saw it.
I see.
See, when you grow at that rate and have staffing problems of various kinds, and the routines are not fully developed, it often happens that you get literally stacks of orders from the faculty, from especially new incoming ones who are enthusiastic or specialists in a certain field. And what then may happen is that a lot of these orders get buried under others. Often a recent flood of orders will cover up an earlier stack. And so I think there were a few misunderstandings, I believe. Some faculty members who felt that they were being slighted.
Where did you have your appointment bottlenecks? That is, your acquisition of staff. Or did or were you able to get the number of lines you needed?
Well, I think that, as I said before, we had staff shortages, but there was great difficulty in recruiting people at the time that this review covers.
I mean, not only Oyster Bay, but the first 10 years on this campus?
Even here?
Yes.
Not so much because of an absolute scarcity of people, but because perhaps we couldn't make the positions quite attractive enough.
Financially?
Even financially. This is, I think it was less of a high-cost area than it is today, but it was already relatively expensive to live in. And I heard it, I remember it well in one case, a bright young woman who obviously was not too far along in her career, but a professional librarian who lived in a rented little apartment in Port Jefferson, didn't suffer, but found it a little hard to make contacts and to get along as a single person. Well, that's the human side of it. You're probably more concerned with the staffing levels and so on. We were too. I think you could argue for that for years. We were looking for fairly high-level library positions that then didn't materialize. Somehow they were pulled back. Of course, at this distance, I assume that they were simply taken by the campus rather than by the state. They were in the official budget, but they didn't get to us.
In the Stony Brook campus?
Yes.
I see.
That, under the assumption, whether this is fair, I don't know, but perhaps under the assumption that lower level people, down to even the volunteer faculty wife level, could do the job if only.
You had that conception from this local administration here?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes. Not permanently, but sometimes.
One of the other constraints that we had to deal with was at times, severe shortages of space. I think even though this building was built in 62, there was so much of it that was taken by the university administration that at points we had material stored all over campus and inaccessible and just not an efficient operation at all.
Well, we went through a period of multi-purpose buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes,
we had to because we didn't. We didn't have the.
It was clear enough to us here that the administration would much rather have had a solid place of their own.
Sure, that's right.
It's quite clear, but in practice, it created points of strain. In service too.
Well, I remember that when I came in 62, mm-hmm. the library was over in the humanities building.
Cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. And my office was in the humanities building, and the cafeteria was there. And then finally, I was able to move over to the library. But not until, I think not until sometime in 63.
Mm-hmm. Took some time to get it
set up. Some time. Sometimes.
Yes.
Did you have any hand in the planning of the building that went all the way around the old building?
Yes,
in the present building.
That was a different process. Mm-hmm. The planning for that got underway when Roscoe Rouse was still director of libraries. In terms of of writing the program for the building, and he left, and there certainly was much more staff involvement in the process, but it seemed to be very late in the process. I mean, plans were presented to us for a reaction, but unless there was something that just was dramatically wrong, very few changes could be made. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why the building is as inefficient as it is. I think that many of us felt that it was just a wrong way to go, a wrong way to, in terms of building the building around the old building, meant that there were compartmentalization of operations that were going to be inefficient, but that decision had been made.
I don't know when.
Yeah, so early.
It must have been quite early.
Right.
I think it was already a set idea by
right.
the time.
And, you know, at the time that we were brought into the process, it was just that basic concept could not be changed. There were things that were changed, but.
Do you remember? I'll put it another way. When I came, I was surprised to find the chemistry building placed next to the library and very close to the library.
Mm-hmm. The graduate chemistry building.
No, the graduate one. The old chemistry building, which meant that you wouldn't have had space to expand very far to the west.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, I think one of the real problems that this campus faces, or has faced, is that there have been changes in campus planners. Boyes, Walker, Smith, Smith, and Haynes were the first campus planners, had a conception of something that was discarded, and somebody else came on board. I think there have been three or four different architectural firms that have been involved in the process, obviously not agreeing with each other, and things had to change over the years, and not necessarily in the best possible way.
Well, and then the graduate chemistry building came along about what time, would you say? But that closed you in also.
Yes.
To the west.
Right.
And was that before 70? Forget.
Well, certainly the planning for that was did impact on what we could do in that direction. And so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Of course, what you are now pointing to also involves the rather early decision, if you want to call it that, to have a departmental library system, that it's departmental libraries for the sciences. Not that I'm against it, but it was. It developed in such a way that these service points for the sciences were minimally staffed, and in professional terms, really just outlying parts of the library collection supervised by a clerk and some student assistants. And finally, we had Ken First, that is a science librarian, but of course he could not be in five places himself. The
First, F-U-R-S-T?
Yes.
Ken First.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a long story and an involved one. This is only one part of a rather major in a university that's so ambitious in the sciences. This is, in a way, a major item, and one that developed piecemeal and almost haphazardly at the insistence mostly of science faculties in different departments, and before the library really had done any serious planning or any serious long-range planning from the service angle.
Well, what would you say Roscoe Rouse's contributions were? Can you?
Well, I would say the first thing that occurs to me is that he was relatively successful in hiring and organizing a sufficiently large workforce, at least to cope with the force, this exponential growth. This was something, this was on a scale that hadn't been there before. I think that's the thing that first occurs to me, and it's no small matter. But I'll stop there and let Don.
Anything else, Don?
No, I think that's certainly what I would consider a major contribution. Mm-hmm. Bringing a structure to a rather amorphous entity that was here before.
Let's see, Vasco. When did he...
Oh, Gerhard Vasco?
Yes.
No. He was here for a while.
As a cataloger.
As a cataloger. Yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right. Stuck on it. And when he came back, was after Vasco's process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was after the Settle on...
Yes. After 17, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to me that the major force in the quality of the collections before 71 was Rubin. He will not say that for himself, but I think that that was certainly your major contribution, and it is a major one to the what is here.
If that is so, I can only think of something Alexander Herzen once said about kings or crowned heads, to recognize the need for progress and not stand into the in the way of it. It's also a contribution. From that point of view, I would say yes. I certainly didn't. Well, anyway, that's a minor matter.
Well, your field is European history, and yeah. It's in the medieval period.
Well, medieval, Renaissance, early modern, and in some respects even modern. Yeah. Right.
And you have languages, German and French.
Yes. And some of the Slavic ones.
And a smattering of Italian and
well, good.
A jack of all trades.
Well, I think that was very, very important at the time that this collection was being built.
Yeah.
Before
we get off Roscoe Rouse altogether, though some people on campus felt that in many ways he had not been a quote success to the extent that they had expected, he really did make a big difference, because he was a librarian who came from a fairly large working library into this one, and knew what certain standards were, which, Don was he started out, as he himself said, I was not that much better. I had been a staff librarian and not an administrator, really, and at that time didn't know clearly enough yet that administrators are born and not made. So, it was a good thing in a way that we had for a while someone who set up something of an organization. It had to be constantly improved.
Where did Rouse come from?
Butler.
No.
Waco.
Baylor University.
Baylor University, and then of course from here he went to Oklahoma State. So he was, he identified with the Southwest.
Is that Stillwater?
It's Stillwater.
Yes.
Yes. I think he retired now.
Yeah. Okay.
Reuben, you didn't have a chance to respond to these questions.
Well,
we can get back to Reuben.
Well, if I respond to them, I probably censor something.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Precisely.
My name, Reuben Welch, department. Retired, but working in the library part-time and now full-time.
Well, you were also in the history department.
Yes. I was first a librarian, then an assistant director of collections, then a director of libraries, then...
Can you give me the years on that, the director of libraries?
I was acting director from 1968 to 69, then, or was it 67 to 68? I'm a little shaky on that. And then director from 68 to 1971, the end of 71, or possibly, I think so.
Was that when Jack Smith came in?
That is when we had an acting director for a while. Was he acting as associate director?
He was associate director and acting director.
Yeah, he was associate before I left.
Gantner.
And was then acting. Mm-hmm. Yes. Gantner from La Jolla, I think it was.
That's correct.
San Diego.
San Diego.
And Jack Smith came in a while later. So, what year did you come? In 1958, just 1 year after Zahn. How old was I at the time? 37. From what institution and position did you come? Again, something a little quirky. I came out of graduate school. I had been a reference librarian for years and went to graduate school at the University of Colorado, initially to get a master's degree, then...
In library science?
In history.
In history.
As something that has now become quite common. Librarians now do seek out a second master, so to speak. One thing led to another, and I stayed on for a PhD. So, in a way, I came out of a somewhat different environment, and perhaps had some mistaken ideas about what would expect me on the other side. I too had an interview with Leonard Olson, but it was only at that time that I discovered that someone was already a librarian and already on the spot. Which was a little, well, it took me aback a little bit. I didn't know that I was going to move in to supervise or be the boss of another professional librarian who was already running the place. Of course, this is in a older, more settled situation. This is, of course, the ideal situation for a director to come in. But in this one, in a way, I felt rather strangely, because I realized that the credit for lifting the place literally off the ground, making the first essential moves, had already been
done. And mistakes.
Well, mistakes you made plenty.
I see that you two got along pretty well.
Oh, yes. In fact, it was very clear to me when I was hired that there were three professional positions, and that I was filling one of the lower level of those three. So I was told that there'd be a director or a head librarian hired almost immediately, and I kept waiting for that to happen, and was very pleased when Ruben did come on board.
I don't know if this is the time to inject some realism into this
Absolutely.
Talk. Because so often it happens that the people hear about an institution or an opening from some colleague or friend, or in some other way that's not on any blueprint or in any conventional situation. And this was the case with me. I had no idea that Oyster Bay or Stony Brook existed until I heard from an old college friend, Ralph Bowen, who was then a full professor here in the social sciences as a historian. And he first told me about this. I said, wouldn't this be great? Why don't you apply? And I did this. I also had the possibility of going into teaching at that time. I had an offer just about the same time, and it was a tough decision to make. I could have been a bibliographer, a rather poorly paid bibliographer at Princeton, which is a library position. I could have been a solid journeyman starting as professor, assistant professor in Kansas, and there was also this position here. And
what attracted you here?
Well, perhaps the lure of the unknown. The possibility of building up something from scratch and presumably being in a friendly environment.
You know, just about everybody that I've interviewed has said that the same thing. There's the possibility of starting something new, starting from scratch.
It's fascinating. It's so fascinating that sometimes people may not ask themselves whether they can really do it or whether they're the best people for it. Well,
anyway, you can grow with the job, and you did.
Well, we all grow in one way or another.
Despite the job, maybe.
My understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook were perhaps faulty at the time. I thought of this perhaps more as a potential state university, forgetting that there were a great many rival campuses on the scene, and that we're really talking about a big system.
You came post-Sputnik.
I came post.
It's amazing what happened at Stony Brook with that, or at Oyster Bay. I think I was hired before Sputnik, and the impact of that on higher education here at Stony Brook, I think, was amazing. This campus that was supposed to be a rather quiet institution to train teachers in science and math, and obviously was going to develop into something much bigger, and it just seemed inevitable.
Yeah.
Well, the Heald report, let's see, I think the Heald report was in 59. At any rate, that was one of the, I think, turning points for the university as such. Heald was president of the Ford Foundation, and what they came up with in terms of the future for Stony Brook became a guide, certainly for Rockefeller. He picked that up and ran with it. Well, go ahead, Reuben.
Well, what factors were most important in your decision to come here? Well, at that time, we were expecting a baby. We were thinking somewhat about the environment we would be in, and perhaps personal, private reasons, so that in some ways Long Island won out over Kansas also on that account. Not that we couldn't have managed very well in Kansas. The first impression, my understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook, as I said, were probably incomplete or hazy. The first impressions were curious. You may recall the first year or two, what you might call the Chicago people, including Leonard Olson, of course,
right,
who tried to raise up the college pretty much in the image of the College of Chicago.
Chicago
and the tensions that developed around this, I mean, this is part of our early history,
yeah,
I'm sure. And something of this you could sense rather soon after getting here. I was always a little farther away. I told you that I was a friend of Ralph Bowen, but I think the tension was far enough advanced to keep me at a certain distance even from Ralph, so that I never quite realized what was cooking until the first, what you might call the big tenure case that's developed with Bowen, Chill, and Fleischer, that Columbia trio that was let go rather quickly.
I see.
And this had an impact. I don't know if any of your previous interlocutors have mentioned this, but I think you can't talk about the early years of Stony Brook without digging into this difficulty. Anyway, I think it affected me a little, and along with that, the very quick discovery of the state bureaucracy and how it worked.
Or didn't work.
Yeah. I think at one point, Don was hoping to write a dissertation in library science on this problem in New York State and its impact on libraries. It would have been a miracle if he could have done it. I don't know if anyone can get in there to find out. But it was something of an eye-opener, and it's a bit of a damper.
Was there any particular person in the central office with whom you, as librarians, dealt with?
I can't recall, no.
Really didn't happen before Diley, it seems to me.
Before whom?
Bob Diley was named
coordinator
of libraries or something in SUNY, but that happened
a little later.
Mm-hmm.
He was a retired state librarian, right. One of the staff of the state library. So before that, I made contact with the Division of Standards and Purchase,
right.
And people like that.
Right.
Who, of course, knew a lot about libraries.
Well, that's...
Not necessarily.
No.